Welcome to On the Line with the AMA, the official podcast of the American Motorcyclist Association. I'm Alexandra Terhorst. Riding on forest trails or across the desert gives us an incredible feeling of freedom. But we can't take that freedom for granted, because for years, opponents of off-highway riding have had motorcycling in their crosshairs. Today's guests are advocates Paul Slovic, recipient of the 2021 AMA Dud Perkins Lifetime Achievement Award, and Cliff Kuntz, winner of the 2018 AMA Outstanding Off-Road Rider Award. For many years, Paul and Cliff have worked tirelessly on behalf of riders in California and Utah, and today, their efforts are benefiting riders across the nation. So how did these two dirt bike advocates become motorcyclists? Here's Paul to start us off.
I grew up in Southern California. Well, I was born in 1942, but by the time I got on a motorcycle, it was about 1961. My first motorcycle was a 1955 Mako, which at the time there was no distributors of that product in the United States. It had been brought over by a GI. So that was kind of my start of that. The second one was a Matchless 500 single, which spit me off many occasions. The first time I raced that motorcycle, Steve McQueen was in the race as well. He won the race and I DNF'd. So that's the start of my riding career.
Well, it was only uphill from there, right?
Yeah, right. I am one of those guys that paid for everybody else's trophies.
How many 100 pounds was this thing?
Which one? The Matchless?
Yeah, well, and I guess that was your second bike, so maybe your very first one.
Well, the first one was a relatively lightweight two-stroke. Earl's Forks, very primitive, probably top speed of, I don't know, 50 miles an hour or something like that, maybe 60. The Matchless was much more powerful. It was a street bike. It was a G80 model that I had to convert. Every time I wanted to go in the dirt, I had to take the back wheel off, put a knobby on it, put a bigger sprocket on it to actually go out and ride that thing. But it was not meant to be a street bike. It had a street tank on it, which was a big, huge chrome tank. It probably hold 4 or 5 gallons.
I just imagine that a bike of that size wouldn't favor the more svelte rider. It was kind of built for a gorilla if you're going to use it off-road.
Well, there was nothing else available at the time. I mean, there are very few true off-road bikes. Greaves, I don't know what else was out there. There were some English bikes, two strokes. That was just kind of the start of the revolution of lightweight bikes coming into the marketplace. John Penton built his Pentons and Sachs, DKWs. I ended up having a 125 Monarch. All those bikes were made for actual dirt bike riding, but Matchless wasn't.
My first time riding was at about 65 miles an hour on the Garden State Parkway, just in the back of my parents' wood-paneled station wagon, dreaming of being on the dirt, kind of in the median. In some parts of New Jersey, that was the only dirt to be found. And so I would just imagine jumping the terrain that passed by the window and flying hundreds of feet. And once I started actually riding, I was jumping more like hundreds of inches. In New Jersey, there was really nowhere to ride and no one that I knew to ride with. And so just convincing my parents to get me a used KDX 200. That's the bike I suggested when I was a teenager. And my dad said, well, go check one out. And I saw it in the driveway of the seller's house and it was white. And I said, well, that's not the right bike. Sorry, there must have been a mix up. And he said, well, get closer and make sure. And I guess that year in 91, they offered the KDX in white and as well as green. And so I said, yeah, actually this is a KDX. And he said, well, good, because I just bought it. So then just learning to ride that kind of in circles in New Jersey and also a cabin in Pennsylvania and just appreciating every inch of trail and then getting out to Colorado for college later in the 90s. And then for the last 20 years in Moab, finally riding with other people that could sort of fix my bad habits that had developed, dragging my feet on the ground or whatever it was, and did a little bit of the racing just to see where I stacked up. And the answer was kind of smack in the middle, the B class. And it was fun, but really I did feel a purpose to help out, not just in terms of protecting our access, but also instilling a responsibility in riders.
As a young desert racer in the 1960s, when off-road motorcycling was soaring in popularity, Paul saw firsthand how regulations, if left unchecked, could ruin the sport he loved. It became the spark that fueled his interest in advocacy.
In the community I lived in Southern California, just outside of Los Angeles, desert racing was a big deal in the early 60s. They would get like 1,000 people on a starting line at some point. Friends of ours wanted to start a desert racing club. You had to be AMA sanctioned at that time. There was no other sanctioning body that I'm aware of. It was District 37. So we were a relatively new club. And in those days, every club had a weekend, and it was like historic weekend that they would put on their event. Well, it turns out in Southern California, in summertime, pretty darn hot out in the desert, so a lot of people didn't put on events. Our weekend was Mother's Day. My whole family never let me forget the fact that I was supposed to be out in the desert on Mother's Day. Nixon's Executive Order 11644, February 8th, 1972, basically set the tone for the management of off-highway vehicle recreation on federal land. Prior to that, you might say it was the Wild West out there. You know, we could get out, set up an event, and ride into the horizon, and nobody cared. Obviously, there were people that cared. After that, I believe I was probably one of the first people to go into a BLM office and ask for a permit, because we had to have a permit then, which was essentially $5 and a one-page thing, fill out the name of your event and your contact information, that was it. And I think we all know that that's no longer the case, that now you have to practically file a brief to put on an event on public land.
When the Nixon order led to the permit requirements, some people would say, well, I'll just pick a different sport, or I'll just race under the radar. In any case, let somebody else deal with it. So why do you think you felt compelled to do something about it?
I think everybody knew that they had to comply with certain regulations, and those regulations over the years just got tighter and tighter. And then we had, and I believe in the mid-90s, we had the Desert Protection Act that was signed off by Congress, took over 8 million acres of the desert away from recreation. And there's been a lot of wilderness bills. You're dealing with those in Utah. But that Desert Protection Act was one of the big, big hammers that hit Southern California.
Image problems have been a long-standing challenge for off-highway riders. Living in Utah, Cliff became a founding member of Ride with Respect. Meanwhile, Paul's work at Honda got him involved with California's Off-Highway Motor Vehicle Recreation Commission.
You need a certain degree of management and a norm of etiquette and things. And so when Dale Perry, a motorcycle tour company owner in Moab, wanted to assemble a board that I joined for this new organization, the name that he chose, Ride with Respect, really encompassed both of those things. It's about riding, but doing so respectfully. And we've had support from hundreds of people over the course of that couple of decades. And some of them emphasize one over the other, but pretty much everybody involved gets both sides of that coin.
That's a great tagline.
It's a statement that you have to live up to, but I think we have thus far.
Honda sent me to Indiana for 6 years, and I was right on the edge of the Hoosier National Forest, and there was absolutely no off-highway vehicle recreation allowed there. I did go to meetings there, but when I came back to California, my boss at the time said, why don't you go to some of these California Off-Highway Vehicle Commission meetings? I started going to them. They were going to have a meeting near the San Fernando Valley, and it was off of Sierra Highway. It was a closed dump, and California State Parks was holding a public meeting to address the situation of buying that closed landfill to turn it into a motorcycle park. Well, the meeting was a complete disaster. And I went away from that meeting with a lady named Dana Bell, who was the AMA rep at the time. But we both kind of shook our heads. This isn't working right. You've got to figure out a better way to introduce the subject of off-highway vehicle recreation to the public without them drawing a line in the sand right off the bat, and then you're done.
I'm glad you're going 50 years back or so to help people figure out kind of where this all came from, not just the activity, but the regulation, to give us an idea of where we might be headed, and also just the fact that it could have really gone any which way. None of this, as I've experienced anyway, is really set in stone. If the different organizations like AMA and especially Honda back then and all the manufacturers today supporting the sport, the future is unwritten. And considering the adversity and the fact that we really tend to be the underdogs in a lot of, at least the off-road side, I suspect street riding is often the same since you're outnumbered by other forms of transportation, recreation. We do really well. I think I've been surprised considering that for Ride With Respect and the groups in Utah, we're typically outnumbered, like we might have a dollar for every $100 that the advocates have, or looking to vastly expand wilderness designations and other things. It can be discouraging, but at times it can also make you feel like, well, you're playing your hand well, and just the potential. If every rider were to join a local club, a statewide association, and a national group like AMA, we'd be kicking butt. And the main thing holding us back, I would suspect, is really just engaging our own riders. Do you get the same sense, Paul, after doing it for about 3 or 4 times longer than me?
Well, you're right. The reality is the average person that's working for a living and has a family and wants to go out and recreate on his side-by-side or motorcycle or whatever it is, doesn't want to get involved in politics and advocacy. They might give a few bucks to your organization, but it's hard to get them motivated. Case in point, there's 2 million people a year that have visited Oceano. And I would say the vast majority of those people had no idea what was going on there.
And for folks outside of the Republic of California, as they call it, that's the Oceano Dunes State Park?
Yeah, State Vehicle Recreation Area is the official designation. So it is a state park, but vehicle recreation is allowed.
So you have something that's tremendously popular, but not necessarily quick for people to defend when the time comes.
The problem is that we're not doing a good job with the public relations aspect of that. Friends of Oceano is working real hard to bring people together. They filed 3 lawsuits since this decision by the Coastal Commission to shut down the park. Hopefully we'll prevail, but it's tough. And that's one of the reasons I'll bring in here the California Outdoor Recreation Foundation that we founded about a year ago to try and turn that around a little bit by telling the story to the public, to the general public and the decision makers, that we're good people. We're family-oriented people. Our recreation is wholesome. We do have some issues, but we deal with them like every other recreation. Right now, we're battling the media. That's the problem. They'd rather paint us in a bad light. They sell more papers that way.
Yeah, whatever portion that's misbehaving, hopefully it's well under 10%, but that's getting a lot of coverage. Meanwhile, the over 90% that are just enjoying it as a lifetime family sport gets virtually no coverage. And so naturally, the general public is going to think that that segment of bad apples represents the majority of riders. And I see it not always just from the traditional media, but from our own enthusiasts. And even on occasion, an advertisement from an OHV-related business won't be quite right in terms of whether it's the helmets or the rooster tails in the wrong place. Do you see this as an issue of educating our own group as far as the importance of PR in addition to educating the general public?
You're exactly right. That's really the thrust of what we're trying to do. I'm in the process of writing grants right now to create media that tells the story properly. I wish the manufacturers would do it, but they're selling product. I wish they would go back to the old days at Honda where we had a long view.
The riding community has learned many lessons from the past. Today, some states have programs that manage OHV recreation. Cliff and Paul talk about the balancing act needed to effectively work with government bureaucracies.
I don't know how old Honda was when they started dominating the market, but it seems like today, particularly those companies that maybe weren't there to learn those lessons the first time around. You know, we had a big environmental movement creating not just executive orders, but like the Organic Act of the BLM and the Modern Forest Service was in the 60s and 70s and NEPA and endangered species, the list goes on. So if you were there, you know the seriousness and what's at stake, the impression that it's really more set in stone, particularly because advocates like yourself have done a good job of keeping places open. So if they haven't experienced the trail closures yet in their motorcycling career, then the awareness just isn't going to be there. And so I'm glad we're talking a little bit about what we've lost.
Let me ask you, Cliff, how was Utah funding their program?
It's from the registration of the OHVs as well as the fuel tax. And I suspect that the recreational trails program helped Utah up its game because you have to have some of that matching component. Today, when you add the state-derived taxes and the federal ones from RTP, we're actually approaching $10 million of OHV funds in the state of Utah. And that's pretty exciting, because there's a tremendous growth in the visitation out there, out of state, as well as people moving into the state. We really need every dime of that to go back to the public lands. How about California?
Our current budget is somewhere in the neighborhood of $75 million a year.
Wow.
About half of that money goes toward the 9 SVRAs and the headquarters operation, and then some other little odds and ends things. The other half of that money goes to grants to the federal agencies. It could be Indian agencies, local governments, and that kind of thing. So there's a grant program to support off-highway vehicle recreation. It's pretty robust, and it has evolved into a very sophisticated program that's web-based. You have to dot the I's, cross the T's, and make sure everything's there. And typically, if somebody gets in the grant program, it takes them 2 or 3 years to be successful. It's a lot of hoops to jump through, but it's put a lot of money on the ground over the years.
Is all of that $75 million coming from OHV taxes of some kind?
The majority comes from gas tax. Some money comes from entry fees and registration, but the majority comes from gas tax. Let me be clear about that. Anybody that travels off highway is potentially putting money into that off-highway vehicle recreation trust fund. That's another thing we need to get the word out.
If the California program is anything like the Utah one, the majority winds up going to conservation work in some form or another. You know, we're rarely making new trail. We're usually maintaining the old trail to minimize the impacts of it. Millions actually go to law enforcement. And the reality of their job is it's not exclusively OHV-related incidences that they respond to. So for us, it's largely getting the word out about the good work that Utah's OHV program is doing and the fact that it benefits far more than just the OHV riders. We haven't had the raid of funds that you've had to combat, I think, over the years, but I could see that coming, and you really don't want to be behind the eight ball if and when there's lean times with state budgets. You want the general public to have known what you've been doing all along, right?
Yeah. You know, you said you guys were approaching $10 million. Our fund has a $10 million a year annual sweep. That means they take the money and put it somewhere else. $10 million a year.
Yeah, that stings.
Well, in our situation, the regular state park system gets money out of the general fund. So they have to go to the governor every year and propose a budget and ask for money. Our money comes in the form of this gas tax. It's supposed to be deposited in a trust fund. It still has to go through the governor for approval. But the bottom line is that our friends in state parks look at a very envious eye with the funding that the OHV program has with only 9 parks when they have something like 270 parks. So there's a bit of a headbutting going on there.
It almost doesn't matter the arrangement. There's always going to be bureaucratic politics. I would hope at the very least each year you would get on behalf of the OHV program a thank you card for the $10 million wherever it goes.
No, I have not seen that.
Years ago, Honda got involved in a nationwide mini bike program to motivate at-risk youth to stay on the right path. Rider education and training was a long view approach that is still effective today.
It's called National Youth Project Using Mini Bikes. The program started, well, going back 1971 or 72, something like that. At one point, Mr. Honda saw the value of using small mini bikes as a youth diversion tool. And the YMCA, they had a Justice Department grant to deal with youth diversion programs. They chose to accept the Honda donation of 10,000 mini bikes to distribute around the United States to use as a youth diversion tool. That was a pretty successful program for a while. And then the Justice Department grant went away and the YMCA kind of withdrew from the program. Several people that were engaged in the program knew how successful it was, and they continued to operate it. Honda continued to fund it, and it had gone down to, from like 300 programs around the United States, something of that number, to around 30. In 2015, I met the executive director of that program, and we had a conversation at Prairie City. I think, Cliff, you were at that.
Yeah.
We started a discussion, and that discussion has evolved into a partnership with California State Parks, providing the facility and a bunch of other stuff, and the NIPM program being the delivery of the kids to our California State Parks. I'll tell you, it is awesome. Right now, the Los Angeles Police Department has embraced the program, and they are taking kids going through the lesson plan. Once they graduate, they can go to one of our state parks, in this case, it's Hungry Valley, and have a weekend there. And it is an absolute amazing opportunity for these kids, teaching them life lessons they would have never learned.
Also a motivator for their performance in school?
Absolutely. They can't even get into the program without elevating their performance in school.
It just speaks to the power of offering a little bit of hope that there's really something to work toward.
Even though they can only utilize a small number of kids, those kids go back and talk to their buddies, mm-hmm. and they get them excited about doing something different. And there's a whole bunch of them standing in line right now in Los Angeles to get involved in this program. And they're trying to be good so they can be in line.
NIPM is unique in the population that it reaches, which is great. But really, for everybody, I can see how much new ridership there is these days from COVID-19 bump, and just hope that we get more of that for everybody. I see that most states have youth riding requirements for going through some kind of course, ideally in person, but at least online. And one of the things that may not be obvious to riders who are just used to resisting regulation, because in some ways we already have too much. One thing that I think could probably benefit us in the long view, as you say, Paul, especially if it's done the right way and overseen by OHV programs that include advisory bodies with people like you and me who are actually enthusiasts, requiring the rider education and certification of adults, just like we do the kids. They already do that in Oregon, and in their case, it's worked well. To me, what it could lead to is better compliance. The 99% would understand what to do, like staying on the trail and slowing down when you pass other people, and the reasons why. For the 1% that aren't persuaded, having rider education and knowing that everybody out there should go through a course, you know, that could help with enforcement as well, because the officer will know that it's not simply an oversight. I hope that other states will consider that going forward.
Education goes hand in hand with this whole thing. You have to have people that are aware of what they're doing and what their responsibilities are. We look to tread lightly. They're creating a lot of messages for our foundation, for instance.
And it's kind of empowering, because especially like on the safety side, you can make more informed decisions when you're out there. And in a lot of ways, I'm kind of lucky to have survived those first few years of being self-taught, because I had plenty of close calls. And in motorcycling, you're always going to have a challenge. It's never going to be delivered to you on a silver platter. I learned things like don't ride in shorts and a t-shirt, you know, and that part I would have much preferred to learn through a course.
Off-highway riding is experiencing a surge in popularity as more and more Americans take to the great outdoors. But with that surge comes challenges, as Cliff describes.
Ride with Respect started basically to assist the land managers, because we could tell as Moab was becoming more popular that we would need to educate more and more people about tread lightly, and also to help with the trail work, delineating the route to keep people on the trail, and doing some dirt work to actually keep the trail fun. Also doing the work beside the route to make sure that people don't go off of it. In addition to being a service dog, though, we do play the role of watchdog as needed. The land managers get tremendous pressure from the other interest groups out there on public lands, and so we just have to make sure we're at the table. And different groups have different approaches, but Ride with Respect, we try to always be constructive and and helpful, and know that if the land manager will do the right thing and find that balance point of the multiple use form of conservation that is their mission at the BLM and Forest Service in particular, that we'll be there to help them. We worked on state lands and we did help map the existing routes, because in any travel planning process, if you don't start with a thorough inventory, you know, you're only going to go lower in mileage from there. Mainly what we've done is just try to maintain or even improve what's there. And hopefully actually teaching the land managers as well as them teaching us some of the hoops that they have to jump through and the constraints they're dealing with. But to be honest, we haven't kept pace with the growth of Moai, which is more like 10% a year. I've been focusing more recently on statewide issues because I like to think it's going to trickle back down to those trail systems that are not being kept up quite as much as they should be. That's what I've been surprised about, is a kid pretending to ride a dirt bike along a highway in New Jersey. I've made a dent, not big enough, but it's been through the organization. That's something that I feel like is less popular these days. People don't want to really join like groups. They might join a social media group because there's really no commitment, but there's really no substitute for organized advocacy.
OHV advocacy has come a long way since the 1960s. And national organizations like the AMA and the National Off-Highway Vehicle Conservation Council make advocates like Paul and Cliff much more likely to succeed.
The AMA knows the people on Capitol Hill, so when it comes to issues like sound, which I know, Paul, you were in on early because California was one of the first to regulate the sound levels from motorcycle tailpipes, and the AMA led the way with a lot of consensus building on what the most effective regulation would be. And then when that issue reached Moab, for example, I could actually point to a solution and sort of hand deliver it. It's good knowing that I have a way of solving this problem, largely through the groundwork of others. Paul, I'm trying to remember, I think that I first met you when you were presenting at the NOVAC annual conference in Michigan. Yeah. And I was pretty overwhelmed by the amount of information, and so it was no surprise that you were instrumental in helping to found NOVAC. And I think I bumped into you the next year in Reno. I probably came across aloof, and that's because I didn't imagine that one of the guys on NOVAC's Mount Rushmore would remember who I was from the year before.
Come on.
But I just was appreciative of the foresight, is it, to start an organization with a tremendous amount of seed money from Honda, and then eventually support from all the manufacturers through the Motorcycle Industry Council, SVIA, and ROVA, because that organization really gave Ride With Respect a boost. It started with presenting at a conference and just realizing that we have all these different states with people in similar circumstances. It's a lot of the same issues that come up, and we can bounce ideas and, if nothing else, provide moral support. And so I always found that although the NOVAC conference would add to my to-do list because I'd want to look into other things, potential new connections, it just rejuvenated me to get back out there. Thanks for thinking of it over a quarter of a century ago.
Well, it was Honda. It was people like Silvio Carrera and Gary Christopher that really started the ball rolling. They had the vision. I was just the foot soldier that made the phone calls.
You know, how many industries have helped to spawn responsible riding advocacy and being on the board of NOVAC today? I'm aware that to try to keep the relations copacetic, but we don't take our orders from the industry. We start from the ground up with the state partners. I just wonder if that has been done with other forms of recreation. There's a certain degree of risk in initiating that collaborative process that I guess Honda did for NOVAC. But again, I think it goes back to the long view that you were talking about, Paul, because if you just look in terms of sort of principles, that having such an organization is going to benefit the sport and hopefully the industry hand in hand. And that's what I think so many of these issues come back to for us. And hopefully, as motorcyclists, we're prone to taking the long view, because whether you're riding in the dirt or on the street, riding teaches you to look a lot further out, especially if you accelerate. The faster you go, the further you have to look. And so hopefully people take that to heart in other aspects of their life.
Our thanks to Paul Slavik and Cliff Kuntz for sharing their experiences and insights into the world of motorcycle advocacy. To learn more about how you can become an advocate, visit AmericanMotorcyclist.com/rights. On the Line with the AMA is a production of the American Motorcyclist Association. Since 1924, the AMA has been promoting the motorcycle lifestyle and protecting the future of motorcycling. Learn more at AmericanMotorcyclist.com.